Happy Groundhog Day. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, February 2nd, 2021. On our show today, learning away from the school building is happening plenty this year. But before the pandemic, there were students who chose to learn virtually. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek finds out how the Fayetteville Virtual Academy operated both before and during the pandemic. And in our second half hour, our militant grammarian looks for the origins of the names of cocktails. Catherine Sheralds and margaritas, Tom Collins and old fashions ahead. This afternoon, following our show, stay with 91.3 KUAF for Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. Today, the Biden administration continues to press for new COVID relief packages, and the Washington Post executive editor Marty Baron announces his retirement. Here and Now starts at 1 this afternoon. The Arkansas Department of Health is adding 27 deaths to the state's list of fatalities from COVID-19. Yesterday's reporting includes more than 1,200 new cases and reductions in the net number of people in hospitals because of the virus and the number of active cases in the state. There are just fewer than 900 COVID-19 hospitalizations in Arkansas. That's the lowest number in 2 months. There are 16,665 active cases. There are 489 fewer active cases in yesterday's reporting than in Sunday afternoon's. Early voting is underway in Gentry and Prairie Grove. Voters in Gentry are deciding if liquor sales for off-premise consumption can take place on Sundays from 10 a.m. until midnight. State law allows for such Sunday sales with voter approval. In Prairie Grove, voters will determine if the city continues taxes to pay off current bonds and issue others for city projects. Election day proper for both elections a week from today, February 9th. A Fort Smith native is being remembered as a champion for his country. Chad Colley, a well-known advocate for veterans and a two-time gold medalist at the 1992 Winter Paralympics in France, died this weekend. Arkansas Senator John Bozeman released a statement describing Colley's life as advancing policies that helped others. We have our first candidate for state treasurer. State Senator Matthew Pitch of Fort Smith announced his candidacy yesterday. He'll seek the GOP nomination for the job held by Republican Dennis Milligan. Milligan cannot seek another term because of term limits. And the Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team home tonight, hosting Mississippi State in Bud Walton Arena. Tip-off scheduled for 8. This is Ozarks at Large. After record cases of COVID-19 at the start of the new year, daily case counts in Arkansas began to decrease toward the end of January. To take a look back at COVID-19 trends in the state during the past month, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Mary Hennigan and Carrie Sider from the University of Arkansas's School of Journalism. Both have been promoted to assistant editors of ArkansasCOVID.com. And during their monthly conversation yesterday, Sider said there were several record-breaking days in January, including the most cases recorded in a single day.
The Arkansas COVID-19 caseloads were very high in the beginning of the month, but toward the end of the month, we saw daily cases decrease, suggesting that Arkansas has approached the end of the third wave. Arkansas averaged 2,262 COVID-19 cases per day in January for a total of 70,130 new cases in the month. That's a 38% increase from cases in December. However, it was a 173% increase in cases from October, which really puts the severity of the holiday surge into perspective. Even though we've seen a recent decline in cases, the virus remains very deadly. On average, there were 39 COVID-19 deaths a day in January for a total of 1,192 deaths in the month. Again, this is relatively consistent with the death toll in December, which was one of the deadliest months in the pandemic. But January recorded a 107% increase in deaths since November, showing the devastating impact of the third wave.
And what kind of an impact has this third wave had on the demographics? Did those change much in January?
Right. So like the last few months, the Native American population had the highest percentage increase in January, and that was at 37%. With such a small population in Arkansas, it's really interesting that the cases have been increasing during the holiday months. However, this group has the lowest count of cases than any other race demographic in the state, and it ended the month with 908 total positive cases. Unlike the last few months, the Asian population had the second highest percentage increase at 32%. The group ended the month with 2,629 total positive cases. And for comparison, the white population increased by 30%. Following those case trends, the Native American deaths had the highest percentage increase. The group now has 10 total deaths. The white population followed with a 32% increase and 863 deaths. For ages, the school-aged Arkansans had the highest percentage increases of the month, with the 11 to 17-year-old age group leading with a 37% increase. The 0 to 10 age group quickly followed with a 35% increase. And both of these groups have the lowest total case counts with less than 25,000 cases each. They both still luckily have zero reported deaths. As for the deaths, the two oldest age groups tied for the highest percentage increase. The 55 to 64-year-old age group added 137 deaths, and the 65-plus age group added 971 deaths. Both of these were an increase of about a third. One standout death in January was a new death in the 18 to 24-year-old age group. It was only the sixth reported death there since the pandemic began. And concerning gender, female cases continued to increase at a faster rate than males. In January, female cases increased by 30% and males by 28%.
A new piece of the pandemic that we've been watching is the rollout of the vaccine. Definitely picked up in January with moving on to phase 1B. And Arkansas COVID has been keeping an eye on the vaccine rollout. What are some of the things that you have found from the data?
So we now have a vaccine information center on our website, which features a clinic locator map and up-to-date vaccine data. As of January 31st, 59% of the total doses received in Arkansas have been administered. So it seems like right now we are going at a good pace at getting people vaccinated, and we're looking forward to the rollout of or the expansion of phase 1B.
The Vaccine Information Center on our website is available in both English and Spanish for our readers.
In the data that you have concerning the vaccine, have you been able to break that out into counties or demographics? I know when I spoke to the Department of Health last week, I asked about race and age and counties, and they said they are working on getting a tab for counties, but I've wondered if you have been able to do any other research in those areas or have heard anything else.
We don't yet have that information by county or by demographic. One thing I will say about the vaccines is that we have an average about 12,000 doses administered a day. And there are, of course, some dips on the weekends, but I just wanted to mention that the weekly averages for the vaccine doses have been increasing by week since we've started.
Any other trends that stuck out to you during the month of January? Obviously, the biggest one with hospitalizations coming down, that was a huge one in the new cases over the last few weeks, steadily declining, also a big one. But anything else that has sort of stuck out to you?
Yeah, the hospital data did two major things this month. It peaked, and it also broke a 64 consecutive day pattern of hospitalizations above 1,000. So January 11th reported the highest hospitalizations, nearly 1,400, and the highest patients on ventilators, 268. And thankfully, Arkansas ended the month with the lowest hospitalization numbers we've seen since before Thanksgiving. So we can only hope that that trend continues.
Well, thank you as always for speaking with us this month, and congratulations on the new titles. And we look forward to speaking to you again next month.
Thank you.
That was University of Arkansas undergraduate student Mary Hannigan and graduate student Katie Sider. The journalism students and assistant editors of ArkansasCOVID.com spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda yesterday. More data analysis of the pandemic, as well as coverage of the vaccine rollout in the state, available at ArkansasCOVID.com. As the COVID-19 pandemic shut down schools to in-person learning last year and school districts have offered other ways of learning this year, thousands more students and parents in Arkansas have been exposed to virtual schooling. But there are families who have been going about learning this way for years because it better suits their needs. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek spoke with students and a teacher at Fayetteville Virtual Academy to find out how their program compares to the virtual learning some might be experiencing because of the pandemic.
I have type 1 diabetes.
That's Harrison Adams.
And so I was having to leave the classroom pretty often.
He's a high school student at Fayetteville Virtual Academy.
And I also just have anxiety, and the traditional classroom setting was just not for me.
Zoe Belasco is a student there too.
My old school didn't really give me enough time to finish my assignments in class. So one of my friends referred us to FBA and we decided to try it out.
And here is her mom, Amber Belasco.
And for me as a parent, I didn't feel that we were getting enough communication and we couldn't help her out as much as we felt that she needed or we wanted to.
But it took Harrison's mom, Susan Adams, who is a former teacher herself, some time to warm up to the idea of virtual schooling.
So it took me a little while to wrap my head around Harrison not being in a classroom. But once we kind of, you know, decided that that was a possibility, it really has worked out extremely well. It takes a little bit of adjustment to kind of find the routine and find your rhythm with it. But he's done really well, and it's been a really good alternative.
She says she was initially concerned by what she thought would be a lack of structure and in-person instruction, but found the opposite to be true.
I've been surprised compared to the traditional classroom and in a regular school setting. I feel like he has had more one-on-one attention with his teachers. And part of that is just because I know it, you know, there's a smaller number of students, but I really was afraid he would have less of that.
Harrison says he communicates with his teachers via email and Zoom. The virtual academy also includes a form of testing called discussion-based assessment, where students demonstrate their knowledge by speaking directly with their teacher. And here's how he describes a typical day in school.
I usually am up around 9 o'clock. I do a couple of hours of schoolwork, take a lunch break, maybe see some friends or...
And you do work in different places, too.
Yeah, and I like to work at different places. The library right now is just reopening, but sometimes I work at the University of Arkansas Student Union. I can kind of hop around, change my environment up.
Since students can work at their own pace in a way that suits them, Harrison says he knows students who complete an entire semester in a month or an entire year of school in a semester. But he prefers to follow the same schedule as his peers in traditional school.
Just that kind of my breaks can align with my friends and I'm not super stressed trying to get it done all at once. So I kind of take it like a traditional school year. My days just look a little different.
Zoe Belasco and her mom have also had to figure out how to best go about her school day.
We get started at around 9:30 or 10. We usually do two classes before lunch, and then we do the last one is usually the easiest one. The harder ones we do at the beginning of the day, so we feel motivated because we know after lunch, we're just not going to want to do anything.
Some of the lessons can last up to 3 hours, but they use that time to also complete assignments. Mom Amber Belasco says because of that, FVA has turned out to be exactly what she and her daughter have been looking for.
I've been able to help her stay on track a bit more. I have a lot more communication with her teachers. And Zoe's in seventh grade. We started in sixth grade. And it's a time when they're held more accountable. But I feel in traditional school, they aren't given a whole lot more tools in order to do that.
But Amber says she realizes that unlike some families who've had virtual education thrust on them during the pandemic, she chose to take this educational path with her daughter.
Which, as we know, when you make a choice for something, you're more invested and it's easier to make the transition. I feel terrible for all of the parents that haven't made this choice and the choice was sprung upon them and made for them. That transition's got to be a lot more difficult for them.
And unlike families in school districts that had just a few months to come up with virtual and hybrid ways of learning, Zoe and her classmates were already set up in a structured program that's been operating for several years. She had this advice for students who are taking classes virtually for the first time.
My advice is to either get on a Zoom meeting or FaceTime if you have their number and call or collaborate with a friend that does the same school as you so you two can work on the same subject in class. Also, email teachers if you have questions. I do that a lot because I have a lot of questions.
As the science teacher for all the high school students at Fayetteville Virtual Academy, William Chesser is on the receiving end of many of those emails. FVA opened to students in 2016, and Chesser has been there for 4 of the last 5 years.
I've had students who were starring in major Netflix series, which some of your listeners have seen. I've had students who were in the top 20 tennis players at the high school level of the nation. I've had students who have millions of TikTok followers.
The goal of Virtual Academy, Chesser says, is to give families flexibility for any number of reasons.
Sometimes I have students who have some social anxiety. Sometimes I have some students who have just some different needs. Sometimes I have students that just want some variety that's not always offered or just some flexibility. And sometimes I have students that have a job outside the home, maybe a full-time job, and they need flexibility. Maybe they're helping pay for things at their home. And so they just need some flexibility of when they can get stuff done.
Chesser has been teaching for 11 years now. And prior to taking a job at FVA, he helped start the Don Tyson School of Innovation in the Springdale School District. He says, personally, he's interested in pushing the envelope of what school can be like.
And I'm really of a mind that we're kind of using a 100-year-old model now, and it works great. It works fine for lots of kids. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to take away that what we call brick and mortar classroom setting, but I also think that we need to stretch a little bit and push education. I think we could use some changes, and I really like kind of being on the cutting or even bleeding edge of that, I have found out.
Unlike virtual learning during the pandemic, where many educators are having to create digital copies of their in-person lessons, Chesser says FVA has a dedicated staff who operates in a different way than teachers in a traditional classroom.
I guess this probably is the big misconception. It's not I'm in class, but I'm at home on my computer on a video class in our case. My job is now partly to go, okay, they're about to study this. I'm going to go find the perfect video for that, and I'm going to insert it, and I'm going to say, hey, watch this video first. I might find 2 or 3 things. Hopefully, I'll be also creating some content that's very fine-tuned and on, okay, I know students always have problems with this, so let me do a lesson on exactly this. So it's kind of like I'm a curator, I'm a librarian, I'm also maybe going to be a performer.
Now, instead of lecturing to classes all day, Chesser says he has more time for one-on-one instruction with individual students. For example, his students get to turn in almost every assignment 3 times.
Not their major exams, but they'll turn something in and I'll grade it and I give them feedback. And then they look at that, and that's part of my instructions. I'm like, hey, change this, right? And that's a thing that in education is viewed as really good, but in a regular classroom environment, it's really hard. But my time is freed up because I'm not lecturing all day, every day.
Chesser says more families chose the Virtual Academy for their children this year than in years prior. The school operates under a conversion charter within the Fayetteville School District. And according to spokesman Alan Wilborn, FVA went from having 221 students to 321. Citing the coronavirus pandemic, the district was approved to expand from an enrollment cap of 500 students in grades 4 through 12 to 5,000 students in grades K through 12. Chesser says the transition to FVA isn't always easy, and some students find they need the social interactions of a traditional school.
But then I've had other kids say, yeah, I was just doing this for COVID, but now I'm staying. This is awesome. I love it. I can work as fast as I want.
As the student council president at FVA, Harrison Adams says he's gotten similar reactions from most of the students who decided to attend the school because of the pandemic.
I think it's just opened that world to a whole bunch of people who maybe should have been there from the beginning, you know, who've kind of found their groove in that. And it's certainly, you know, certainly some people it's not for them. And they've realized that now. But I think that just even though it was obviously under bad circumstances, I think a lot of students have kind of found where they're supposed to be.
According to the latest figures from the Arkansas Department of Education, about 20% of Arkansas students are learning virtually. 12% opted for the hybrid model, and the rest are back in school in person full time. A Department of Education survey released last month found that about one in every three parents who responded said their children who are learning remotely this school year are learning less than they would in a normal year. Chesser's advice to parents and students who are doing virtual learning as a matter of necessity rather than choice is to communicate with their teachers.
So reach out. We need help of parents and students to just email us and say, like, hey, I'm having trouble. What do I do? I think that would be my number one thing.
And for those who are interested in what FVA is doing and how they're doing it, Chesser says students can take a course without enrolling in the school full time.
I think the goal should be more options, more flexibility, right? I have no belief that we would replace brick and mortar, but I do think we can supplement it. And I think we can offer a lot to students who want something a little different.
While school districts were granted waivers to provide digital learning options for students during the 2020-2021 school year, any schools that choose to offer a remote program in the 2021-2022 school year will need to seek State Board of Education approval. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
Students don't have to live in Fayetteville to attend Fayetteville Virtual Academy. They can move to the school using a school choice application or a school district transfer. Aside from FVA, the Fayetteville School District also offers a separate district-based virtual classroom at each of its schools to give families another option for learning during the pandemic.
Theater Squared presents Schoolgirls, or the African Mean Girls Play. This comedy features Paulina, the reigning queen bee at Ghana's most exclusive boarding school, Erica, a new student with undeniable talent and beauty, and the Miss Global Universe pageant. On stage through February 14th, 777-7477 or theater2.org for tickets and information.
This is Ozarks at Large. What we've learned about distance work and distance school the past 10 months means we may not have to live close to our offices or schools in the future, perhaps by that idyllic cottage far away. But globally, we've been moving toward cities, not from them. A 2016 study by the U.S. Census Bureau indicates about half of the population in the United States lives in mostly urban counties, only about 9% living in what the Bureau describes as mostly rural counties. A projection by the United Nations estimates more than two-thirds of the world's population will be living in urban areas by 2050. Concern about making those urban centers sustainable is growing, too. Next fall, a University of Arkansas Honors College signature seminar titled Sustainable Cities will consider elements of sustainability in growing cities. Noah Billig, Associate Professor of Landscape Architecture in the Faye Jones School of Architecture and Design, will lead the course. And he's offering a preview lecture open to the public on Zoom tomorrow evening beginning at 5:15. Last month, he told us the world's population is shifting to urban settings.
We're becoming more and more urban, and that trend is expected to continue despite some migration away from cities during COVID-19. It's still anticipated that we're going to be more and more urban, and we reached the 50% threshold a little over a decade ago. And not only are people moving to cities for opportunity, but now cities are seen as the part of the solution for problems like climate change and biodiversity loss.
I bet some people will hear that and it will be counterintuitive to them that cities are a chance to battle climate change and some other problems.
Yes, it is. It's a lot of what I'll talk about in this course, but then also what I talk about in other courses is counterintuitive. And a lot of times people associate cities with all the negatives of cities, you know, from the Industrial Revolution through today. And really there's, you know, if we think of things in terms of per capita, cities are known to have the potential to be a lot more efficient. And there's a lot of opportunity that comes in to cities in terms of social opportunity, economic opportunity. But then there's also opportunities to preserve environments and landscapes and habitats and resources that otherwise would be developed.
It's a big word, opportunities. Doesn't mean reality necessary, but there are opportunities.
Yes. Yeah. So it's, you know, we've had a lot of lost opportunities, I would say, in the U.S. in particular, in terms of how we've developed our cities. But going forward, there's going to be opportunities to reimagine how we inhabit our cities. And I think there's opportunities in Northwest Arkansas, for example, to be ahead of the trend, right? So we're expected to double in population. We've grown, we all know we've grown a lot in the last two decades, but we have the opportunity to do it in a more sustainable fashion. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. So it's going to take different operations in order for that to happen. So it's not a matter, in my opinion, and other people have the same thought, it's not a matter of repeating everything we've done in the last 70 years. It's a matter of looking at things in a more critical way and in a more comprehensive way.
What's an opportunity or two that we could, in Northwest Arkansas or another city, take advantage of in the next decade or so?
Well, there's a lot of infrastructure that exists in our downtowns and beyond our downtowns as well. And there's a lot of, for example, vacant lots that are not developed or underdeveloped that could provide infill opportunities for the cities. And so we have a lot of existing infrastructure in the form of roads or sewer lines or other types of infrastructure, or at least access to that type of infrastructure that could be developed. And I hate to say it, but it could be developed in a more densely. I don't always like to use the word density, but we have opportunities to develop more densely, but then also provide amenities that can go along with that density. And so I think a lot of times opportunities for the benefits of urban living are lost in how we develop. So sometimes we have what we sometimes call density without the amenities. And so it doesn't do anyone any good to live more densely if you don't have the amenities that could come along with that. For example, walkability or access to jobs or the grocery store, the coffee shop, or transit. And so if we think about providing the benefits of urbanism kind of writ large across the region, not just for those living in the central cities, but living in the, you know, in pockets throughout the region, that's a huge opportunity in the future. And then I also think there's opportunities in the larger region in other cities. So kind of mid-sized U.S. cities that are starting to see more greater influx of residents and young people, for example, that are finding cities like Austin or San Francisco too expensive. People are moving back to places like Kansas City, Tulsa, St. Louis. And so there's potential for an urban renaissance to happen in these places in a more affordable way than this happened already.
We've just gone through this, or continue to go through, but we've had 10 plus months of a global pandemic where almost every city in the world has had to change something. Are there opportunities to learn something from the last 10 months? Can we figure something out about cities that maybe we wouldn't have without the dramatic shifts in lifestyles?
Well, I think there's really an opportunity to understand the importance of landscapes and public space. And I think that's become apparent in every city across the globe, right, to some degree. And we've seen at the neighborhood scale where the holes are, you know, where we have, for example, in Northwest Arkansas, we have a great trail system, but depending on where you live, you might not have access to that trail system. And we're starting to realize the importance of landscape, and I have the perspective of a landscape architect, but the importance of great landscape architecture in public space and the public realm. And we've spent, you know, many decades building up the private realm in a lot of American cities, and we're realizing that the public realm is just as important, right? And if not more important in these cases. And it's one of the reasons we live in cities. And of course, it's also the way we exercise our democratic rights and values, right, and our voice. So I think that people are not, the demand for public space is not going to let up, is my prediction from in a post-COVID era.
Do we in Northwest Arkansas have not an exclusive challenge, but an unusual challenge in that we're a region with four or five cities, and that means four or five different governments, so decisions aren't necessarily unilateral across the metro area?
Yes, and that's something that's true in a lot of metropolitan areas, right? So a lot of the action happens at the municipal level, and sometimes municipalities are competing for different resources, right? So, or different projects of various kinds. So sometimes that's not good for the region as a whole. So the more cooperative organizations we have, the better. And I think we have that, but we don't, but you're right in terms of the power oftentimes lies at the municipal level. I think it's a challenge, but I also think there's an opportunity to really enhance and foster the four or five cores of Northwest Arkansas. And it's unique in that way, having such a, well, there's some other examples, but you know, there's not, I don't know of another example that's burgeoning in the same way Northwest Arkansas is, that also has this linear nodal system. So there's opportunities for a regional transit system that would fit right into that. And there's also opportunities for this infill development as well in all four or five cities.
For the best chances at sustainable cities, do we have to consider economic justice and matters like that?
Yes, absolutely. It's unknown by a lot of people that this is part of sustainability. And sometimes I think of the triple bottom line of sustainability of environmental, social, and economic sustainability. But they don't connect economic justice as part of this. And the fact is, a lot of our wealth that's been built in the United States over the last couple generations has been through property value, right? And through rising property values that some people were left out of because of racist policies. And so these legacies of environmental injustice are still with us. And sometimes that's in who's built wealth over generations. Sometimes it's where pollution is located. You know, it's actual heat island effects in some urban areas. And so, it's critical. And we also see in cities that are really prosperous, huge issues with affordability and access for everyone. You know, so as if we're really going to be truly sustainable, we have to think about how we can look at these things in a different way. And it's complicated, and it's not, I think it's with great hubris if a designer thinks they can do it themselves, or a planner thinks they can do it by themselves. And so it's a really interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary endeavor, right? We have to have all people cooperating as we approach these things, and not in one way it has to be a long-term approach, but it also is really urgent, right? Like these problems need to be addressed, or issues of sustainable cities need to be both addressed in a resilient sort of way, but addressed in an urgent way.
Noah Billig is an associate professor of landscape architecture in the Faye Jones School of Architecture and Design at the University of Arkansas. He will lead a UA Honors College course titled Sustainable Cities next fall. His preview lecture, open to the public, will be on Zoom beginning at 5:15 tomorrow evening. You can find more information at honorscollege.uark.edu, and we have a link to a registration form for tomorrow evening's talk at ozarksatlarge.com.
If you work with a nonprofit organization in the KUAF listening area, you know the value of a dollar. But did you know that KUAF offers a special underwriting rate for nonprofits? Find out how to reach your target audience without breaking your marketing budget. I'm the KUAF Underwriting Director, and I'm here to help. Send me a message at rhonda@kuaf.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. The 2022 race for Arkansas's next governor is underway. Three Republicans are officially in: Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin, and, as of last week, former White House Press Secretary and Arkansas native Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Last week, Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, talked with John Brummett, political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, about the announced candidates and some who may announce later.
And the Republican, on the Republican side, Griffin took a nice little shot that she didn't know what she was talking about, which doesn't matter in the Trumpian era, at least about whatever that issue was he raised. I forget. You probably remember.
Sanctuary cities.
Sanctuary cities, yeah. We already don't allow those. And there, if we didn't have this concern, so every city in Arkansas would be a sanctuary city. There's just liberalism run amok out there in rural Arkansas, and they've got to stop this. I'm being facetious. I've seen polls, there have been consistent polls that show Sarah Sanders very well could defeat Rutledge and Griffin without a runoff. I mean, she's a rock star in rural Arkansas, and Trump has not been harmed by League and insurrection. He's still a man out there, and she was his agent. So, and I think she knew that in her announcement. That's the card, the lay-down hand she played. The politics of the gubernatorial politics of Arkansas since Rockefeller and Bumper for decades has been one of moderation, pragmatism, modernization of our economy, all those things. There's another thing about Arkansas that distinguishes it during that time, before, and now, and it is a cussed independence of the Arkansas people. I hesitate to mention the cliche election, but in 1978, the people of Arkansas voted for George Wallace for president, J. William Fulbright, an anti-war Democrat for Senate, and a New York liberal Republican, Rockefeller, for governor.
1968,
not 1978. Did
I say 78? You did, but I forgive you.
Well, I'm sorry. I knew it was 68.
Go ahead.
I did know that. Anyway, so that independent seed still exists out there. Now, here's what's happening. There are two moderate, pragmatic, accomplished gentlemen who are looking at Arkansas and saying, yeah, it's probably going to be Sarah Sanders, but she can be alienating. When you really get down to it, maybe she just gets the Trump base. And then the Democrats are weak. They're lucky to get 32-35% against anybody. And if you could get some of their vote and get, and if one of them said to me, there are a lot of BBDs and Rockefeller R's out there left in Arkansas, and they have no place in this new environment. The two candidates are State Senator Jim Hendren and former House Speaker David Carter. And they're both on Twitter like Trump's. They don't tweet as in such an incendiary fashion, but with great frequency. And they're out there blasting Trump, blasting Republicans. So I'm on the phone, or I'm trying to communicate with them and their people today, wondering if they're both highly egomaniacal people, and I say that in the kindest way. If there's a, I don't know how they both can exist. There can be only one, in which it will be, and how that will be determined.
Edited comments from a conversation recorded last week between John Brummett, political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. Since that conversation took place late last week, a few days earlier than the usual discussions we feature here, some editing was done to eliminate dated material. You can find the entire conversation at talkbusiness.net. And Roby Brock and his team at talkbusiness.net are doing daily updates regarding the legislature. You can find that coverage at talkbusiness.net. And you can find John Brummett's columns at arkansasonline.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today over the phone here in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio, joined with Leah Frieden, a reference librarian at the Fayetteville Public Library. Leah, nice to talk to you.
You too. Thanks so much for having me.
We're talking about a series of events taking place this week, running through Sunday. It's called Lift Every Voice. Describe what this is and how it came about at the Fayetteville Public Library.
Sure. So Lift Every Voice is a national public humanities initiative, and it was founded by the Library of America. And what it is bringing attention to African-American poetry. And so libraries all over the country that receive this grant have their own local programming on the topic of African-American poetry.
What are some other topics taking place throughout the week as well?
We're going to be posting some wonderful videos that the University of Arkansas Libraries Special Collections created for us. They have created some videos with selections from their African-American poetry collections. Mm. So there's some highlights from John Paul Dunbar, Langston Hughes. They have an anthology of poetry that was published by the Works Progress Administration in 1937. They have modernist Black poetry that was influenced, that influenced jazz musician John Stubblefield. Just lots of great stuff. We have a spotlight author, two authors that have written a book together, Jeffrey Davis and F. Douglas Brown, and they wrote a book together called Begotten, which is a book of poetry on the topic of Black fatherhood, and they're going to be discussing and reading from their book. And then towards the weekend, we're going to have a concert on Saturday afternoon, a virtual concert, Ozark Waba. They are Afropop, reggae, West and South African-inspired music. They're local here to Northwest Arkansas, so we're very excited about that. That's going to be a fun one. And then on Sunday afternoon, February 7th, we'll have local poet Natasha Devon. She's going to lead a workshop called Poetry as Healing. So it's going to be a supportive and interactive workshop based around the idea that poetry can help heal.
It's called Lift Every Voice, Why African-American Poetry Matters. Speaking with Leah Frieden with Fayetteville Public Library. Okay, Leah, someone wants to tune in for all of these. What's the best way to learn more?
The best way to learn more is to visit the Fayetteville Public Library's website, faylib.org. That's faylib.org.
Leah, thanks so much for letting us know what's going to be taking place this week.
Thank you.
The Community Spotlight and KUAF Public Radio. Local matters.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me via Zoom, our militant grammarian, Catherine Sherrills. Catherine, welcome back.
Thanks. Kyle, the year 2020 gave us lots of reasons to try new cocktails.
Agreed.
Nielsen reported a 54% increase in national sales of alcohol for the week ending March 21st, 2020.
Yeah.
But since then, the increase has averaged about 25 to 30%. So while we're imbibing, maybe we should find out a little bit more about the origins of the names of common cocktails.
Oh, I love it.
WordGenius.com says the history of modern cocktails can be traced back to 18th century England, where folks would gather in punch houses and drink from large punch bowls, obviously spiked punch
right.
bowls.
And obviously something we didn't do in 2020.
Yeah, really, we didn't. Well, unless you got really thirsty and made it for you and Laura.
Right, right.
Okay, so Kyle, tell me what you know about an old fashioned.
Old fashioned is my wife Laura's favorite drink, and you put some bourbon in there, and you put some simple syrup, and you could put bitters in there, and you top it off with a cherry.
Mm-hmm. Simple and, well, old fashioned.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's how it got its name.
Yeah.
So, what's in a Tom Collins?
You got your gin, probably some seltzer or soda, and a little bit of lemon and lime. lemon or lime, depending.
And some simple syrup.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where do you think it got its name?
Well, I'm going to guess there was a bartender named Thomas Collins, but that's probably wrong.
By all accounts, there is no mixologist named Tom Collins behind the drink.
There you go.
Which is pretty surprising. Part of the name came from a gin drink called a John Collins. Hmm. And I guess we don't look up why it was called a John Collins. There probably was a mixologist named John Collins. Mm-hmm. And there's also an urban legend about an 1870s prank that involved sending bar hoppers and on wild goose chases looking for the mysterious Tom Collins.
Sort of a bartending snipe hunt.
So he was the
hunt.
Snipe
yeah.
of the day.
Yeah.
Snipe hunts.
Right.
Okay, Kyle, do you like fancy margaritas or just the straightforward kind?
Oh, I'm known to like both, actually.
Mm-hmm. What's in a straightforward kind?
Tequila, triple sec, and lime.
Yep. And what would you guess is the origin of the name margarita?
It's named for somebody's muse, Margarita, who could have been named Margaret, as we learned a couple of weeks ago.
Earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one's logical. Margaret Margarita Sames claimed to invent the drink in 1948. However, Jose Cuervo Tequila advertised the drink dating back to 1945.
Hmm.
So that kind of put a hole in, I guess Margarita could have invented
sure.
the drink earlier and claimed to have done it in 1948. It might also have been invented by Danny Negrete for his sister Margarita's wedding in the 1930s.
Okay.
What we do know is that Margarita is Spanish for, do you remember from a couple of weeks ago?
It was one of the Daisy.
Yeah, it's a daisy. So it's quite possible that the drink came as an evolution of another flower named drink, a tequila daisy or a magnolia.
Huh, interesting.
So, Kyle, what goes into a mimosa?
It is champagne, orange juice, and a desire to have an early Sunday afternoon nap.
Yeah. It does play a key role in any brunch, especially those on Sunday.
Yes.
As well as creating a perfect excuse to drink before noon.
Yes.
The vivid orange-yellow color is reminiscent of the mimosa plant, which is where the name comes from. And mimosa plant, I assume they mean the flower of the mimosa tree?
I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know whether I didn't look it up. I should look up and see if there's a mimosa plant that's different. But I do have a friend who went to – he's not the kind to go to many fancy dinner parties, but he went to, I think, a brunch with his wife and was given his first mimosa.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked if it was made with the tree, the mimosa tree that was growing all over his property. Okay. What liquor is Cuba particularly known for?
Rum.
Since Cuba is the birthplace of some particularly tasty brands of rum, it's natural that Cubans created more than one way to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had a mojito?
I have indeed, yes.
And what is that?
You've got rum and, it's sweet. Lime, right?
I think lime is in it. What is the really kind of outstanding ingredient that's not – it's in the preparation?
I'm much better drinking them than making them.
It does definitely say that there's a prominence of lime in the drink.
Okay.
Yeah. But what they do is they start out with mint.
Right. Of course, yes.
And what do they do with it?
They put it in the – they get a what do you call it, a pestle and a mortar and pestle, and you muddle it.
Yeah, you muddle it, right. In Espanol, mojo is the name for a Cuban citrus marinade.
Mm.
So So mojito. Mm. The prominence of lime in the drink, which also features muddled mint, mm-hmm. permeated through to the name mojito, which means little mojo.
Oh, I like that.
Mojito. Yeah. Sheldon of the Big Bang Theory.
Yes.
Found a way to fit in with the cocktail crowd and still maintain his dislike for alcohol. He would order a Cuba Libre without the rum.
Right.
So what was he left with?
He was drinking a Coca-Cola.
Yeah, right. A Cuba Libre is a rum and Coke with a squeeze of lime.
Right.
Literally translated, Cuba Libre means free Cuba. It is thought that the drink was created after the liberation of Cuba from the Spaniards during the Spanish-American War in 1900, though it is unclear whether the drink was made by Cubans or Americans.
Interesting.
Yeah. And finally, from Cuba, the daiquiri.
Oh, I'm not a big daiquiri drinker, but I had an amazing daiquiri once in Puerto Rico at this bar. It was just amazing.
Was it simple and not all gussied up?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. What goes in a simple one?
Let's see. You've got, what is it, a daiquiri?
This has three ingredients.
Okay, so.
Rum.
Rum, right. God, there's something sweet. It's not sugar itself, but there's something sweet in there.
Simple syrup.
Which, of course, I have made simple syrup before, and you use sugar to melt it or burn it down or whatever you do to it on the stovetop. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the final ingredient that always goes with
lime.
Rum. Lime. Daiquiri is a village on the southeast coast of Cuba. Supposedly, the drink was also invented around the Spanish-American War, this time by Americans who ran out of gin and had to figure out the best way to enjoy the Cuban rum. So they added sugar and lime.
Wow.
And once the whirling cocktail freezers came along, daiquiris lost their simplicity and now come in a myriad of artificial flavors.
Indeed they do, yes.
Salud, Kyle.
Salud, Militant. Grammarian is Catherine Sherrills.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Little Guys Movers, a community-oriented company rooted in creating better lives for customers and employees alike, providing jobs and serving customers for over 28 years. More than just a moving company, littleguys.com for information.
Opponents of time change, sorry, but your fight continues in Arkansas. Legislation that would have adopted with federal approval to adopt daylight savings time year-round in the natural state failed to emerge from committee yesterday. The bill by Representative Johnny Rye from Truman failed after other legislators voiced concerns about dark treks to the school bus for Arkansas students and possible damages to commerce with neighboring states still shifting the clock. So we'll continue to spring forward and fall back for the time being. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Eureka Springs. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Groundhog Day edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Greta and Susanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis produced our show in his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Our militant grammarian is Catherine Sherrills. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio. The conversations we feature between John Brummett, political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Rock with our partner Talk Business and Politics represent part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. Our theme, written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find him online. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for being with us. You can find out more about us at ozarksatlarge.com. And you can subscribe to our absolutely free podcast version of our daily show by going to any major podcast distributor. Please take care of yourself. Back with you tomorrow for another brand new show.